Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the bad news on three fronts for Trump, who has been hiding his taxes from the Congress and the public, peddling the absurd lie that he is under IRS audit. Today, New York state lawmakers approved a bill to clear the way for Congress to get Trump's state returns, which have copies of his federal tax returns attached. And also today, a federal judge blocked Trump's attempt to block congressional subpoenas from the House Financial Services Committee and the Intelligence Committee for his banking records, following Monday's rejection by another federal judge of Trump's argument to block the release of records from his accounting firm. And in hearings today before the House Financial Services Committee, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin denied that a leaked IRS memo contradicted his reasoning for denying the House Ways and Means Committee Trump's tax returns, and he also denied that he had broken the law in not turning them over to Congress. Edward McCaffrey, chair in law and a professor of law, economics, and political science at the University of Southern California, and the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, joins us to discuss Trump's tax travails and his tantrum today, cutting short a meeting on infrastructure with Schumer and Pelosi that lasted 3 minutes because Nancy had said he was engaged in a cover-up. Then we will speak with David Dayan, who is the executive editor of the American Prospect and the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize, about how Trump's use of immigration as a wedge issue to throw racist red meat to his base disguises the wholesale looting of the Treasury by his cronies, which is made clear by a recent report that Trump has only built 1.7 miles of his border wall at a cost of $1.57 billion, meaning it's costing the taxpayer roughly $1 billion a mile. And if it's not already clear that the Trump cabinet is a team of grifters, yesterday's testimony by HUD Secretary Ben Carson made it glaringly obvious that he neither knew anything about the government department he oversees or cares at all about the people HUD is supposed to serve. Then finally, you'll look into the bizarre story uncovered in documents obtained from the Russian troll factory run by Putin's chef Prigozhin that included a blueprint, development strategy of a pan-African state on U.S. territory. Casey Michel, who has worked as a journalist in both the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, joins us to discuss this plan to recruit a group of prominent gangbangers and send them to Africa for demolition training so they could return to the U.S. to wreak mayhem and create a separate country, which Michael Harriet of The Root refers to as Black Manistan. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Edward McCaffrey, who is the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and a Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and founder of the People's Tax Page. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward McCaffrey.
Oh, it's great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank
I'm exhausted just listening to hear outlines of what you're going to talk about in this hour. I mean, it is a crazy world out there, so...
It is.
Great to have people like you navigating us.
Well, I'm also throwing a lot on your plate, Ed.
Yeah.
So where do we begin? Where do we begin with the various strands closing in on Trump?
Because I heard what you teed up there, and that's what really got me excited just on my segment. So you have these multiple stories. You've got New York State passing a law that says if Congress asks for them, they will give Trump's or anybody's, they will give the New York tax returns to Congress. So that's one story. Then we have Mnuchin appearing before a House committee and being grilled by Maxine Walters and others because an IRS memo from last fall says the law that clearly states that the IRS has to turn over the tax returns to Congress for any citizen that Congress asks for it. That law is as clear as everybody else thinks the law is clear. The IRS itself is saying Trump doesn't really have a leg to stand on. And then we have two court decisions that quickly come out and mock, essentially, the Trump legal arguments, which are all about how Trump doesn't have to share anything. And then Trump has a temper tantrum saying he's the most transparent president ever. So I think it's all linked, and I think it's good news for the resistance. And I think we can see, you know, maybe, you know, after the devastating blow of the Mueller non-report report, lots of us, I think, progressives were sitting around waiting for a smoking gun. And they didn't get the smoking gun, and they got depressed. But a day like today shows that maybe there's wisdom behind Pelosi's strategy, but we might be seeing death by 1,000 pellet guns. We're seeing the pawns rise up and surround the king. And Trump is going, his you know, crazy arguments, his poor legal arguments are being shot down in the courts. They're being kind of ridiculed. Internal leaks are showing that he's just a bad hat on all these transparency issues. Other states are rising up to go after him and go after, you know, the sort of jewels of the kingdom, his state secrets of his own finances. And all that stuff is not going to come out in a big smoking gun, but it's going to drip out. And he's getting hit on multiple fronts. And here, finally, in my opening spiel, because I loved your opening, non-spiel, but your opening outline, here's another kind of deep irony in where we are. What is it that you've got Barr now saying he's doing all this, Attorney General, quote-unquote Attorney General Barr, saying he's doing all this for the office of the presidency, so that all these things that the Trump administration is asserting to block access to Trump's records, his tax returns, his financial records, his connections with money laundering schemes, all these things that Trump administration is fighting, they're fighting in the name of the presidency and particularly the president's right to privacy, right to financial privacy. So we are moving mountains and making bad arguments to protect the privacy of our own president. What's the other big story in the news? The attack on Roe v. Wade. What is Roe v. Wade based on? A woman's right to privacy. Not financial privacy, not privacy of tax returns, privacy of her reproductive decisions, privacy about her decisions, her medical decisions. That right to privacy, conservatives want to completely eliminate and wipe off the face of the earth, claiming, among other things, there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. But somehow, our own president's rights to the privacy of his financial records take precedence over everything, the Congress, courts, anything. So I think it's you're right to link these stories. You're right to say that Trump kind of went 0-for-4. I think you're right to also link these stories to the kind of temper tantrum in the Rose Garden, because having maybe felt a sense of relief, no obstruction, no collusion, quotes unquote, and that he was in the clear, I think he's Macbeth. He's under siege from multiple angles, and he's got bad weaponry to fight these attacks. He's got bad legal arguments, and the courts are moving quickly to shoot it down. New York is moving quickly to shut it down. And, you know, final point, if it comes down to, if the fate of the resistance comes down to a 1v1 of Maxine Waters versus Steven Mnuchin, good day for the resistance.
And again, I'm speaking with Edmund McCaffrey, who's the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and Professor of Law, Economics and Policy and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. And Ed, your sound is fluctuating. So if there's a way that we can get you in a better position on the phone, because you sounded really good for a while and then you drift off in a way. So just Tell me what you think is going to happen then on the Mnuchin front, because he's breaking the law.
Well, yeah, I mean, any of these people, they're
what you're doing now, by the way, is right. So whatever you're doing now, stay with that, okay?
Okay. I got it. So so back to talking about the Mnuchin thing?
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, on the Mnuchin, I think a number of them are breaking the law. You know, Don McGahn is defying a subpoena. I think, quote-unquote, Attorney General Barr probably broke the law in a lot of ways. All of them who are breaking the law are saying they're not breaking the law because they're torn between these two different branches of government, and their allegiances rest in the executive branch, Article 2, and they all have some piece of paper from the Office of Legal Counsel, some lawyer in Article 2, in the executive branch, in the White House, who's saying that what they're doing, they have to do because of their duties to the president. So that you know, one way or another, this is going to come to court. All these things are going to come to court. My sense would be that you resolve the substantive issue. You go to court on whether or not the tax return should be turned over to Congress. In my opinion, they obviously should. Once that's happened, I don't know if you need to circle back and say, well, Mnuchin, you were violating the law because you always should have turned them over. I think, you know, at that point, the Democrats can find people if they want to arrest them for defying subpoenas. I doubt it would be Mnuchin. And even though the legal argument he's putting forward is very, very thin and highly unlikely to prevail in court, it gives him enough cover that it would be shocking at this point if Congress went directly after Mnuchin. But they have to go, and they are. They're going to have to go after the position. They're going to have to get the tax returns.
Well, clearly, you've got toadies like Mnuchin, and you've got, and arguably Barr too. But Barr, to address the point that you made, that the hypocrisy of him defending Trump's privacy over his tax returns at the same time ignoring women's privacy in terms of overturning Roe v. Wade. And of course, we don't know whether Barr is a member of Opus Dei, but he's certainly a member of the Federalists and a very conservative Catholic. So there's no, you know, one I can understand where he's coming from. But
that point about Tony's, by the way, too, I think another parallelism is the way, again, glimmers of hope. I'm, for whatever, it's a beautiful day here in Los Angeles, so the sun is shining and I'm claiming it's a good day for the resistance. There's evidence in the Barr DOJ that they're sort of do-gooders in-house, that there are still rule of law people, maybe not Rod Rosenstein, but they're rule of law people who are working in there. We get leaks. We see people standing up. That seems to be parallel in Treasury, because the IRS commissioner, Chuck Rettig, a local Los Angelino, and in my opinion, a decent guy, he's staying out of this. Mnuchin took it over. So it's Treasury Department, and the leaked memo from the IRS, first of all, somebody leaked that memo. Second of all, when the IRS looked at this issue, they said, well, this is completely clear. We're going to have to turn them over unless the president asserts executive privilege. Now what we're seeing with Mnuchin is the IRS is out of it. They're not relying on the IRS lawyers. They're not relying on the IRS commissioner. It's Treasury and that OLC. So there's an inner core of toadies, as you called them, and there's not too many of them, but they're taking over increasing power. So the inner citadel is shrinking. Macbeth is being surrounded. His court of couriers is, you know, getting hit by, you know, arrows everywhere. And I don't know. Again, I'm spinning happy metaphors today, but certainly parallels between Mnuchin taking a matter away from the IRS, bringing it in-house, and then defying the legal expertise of career officials. We've seen the exact same script with Barr, taking things away from career officials in DOJ who are playing it by the book,
who are not saying what Barr is saying. Barr usurps their authority and then takes the toady position for his audience of one. Mnuchin is from that playbook.
Sure. Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, do you think that since Trump's legal position is so absurd in all of these cases, is it such that the judiciary is sufficiently stacked by the Federalists and Barr's people that Mitch McConnell is pushing through at an extraordinary clip? Or are there enough people in the judiciary? And even the people, the Federalists, I mean, they're supposed to be, you know, textualists. So isn't it pretty clear that the courts have to shut Trump down and shoot him down, I mean?
Yeah, and that's going to continue. Again, we got 2 or 3 minutes here, and I appreciate your time. But that'll continue my optimism for today. Because, again, I think the resistance's best ally is Trump himself. I think he's pushing very weak legal arguments here that are getting, and on all of the things that we've been talking about, we'll have to see about the litigation over New York's attempt. But the argument over not turning over the tax returns, the argument against the subpoenas and the Deutsche Bank and Mazars cases, those are very, very bad arguments. They're getting shut down quickly at bench trials by career judges who are mocking the arguments and ruling on an expedited basis. The Mazars one goes up to Merrick Garland, and I would expect another quick move from the appellate court just affirming the lower court ruling. At that point, you might just get cert denied by the Supreme Court. Supreme Court doesn't even want to touch it. And that's the kind of resounding victory. That's what pawns can do when they're in the right position, right? They can checkmate mm-hmm. the king. So instead of making, you could fight over whether there was collusion or obstruction in the Mueller report and obfuscate and get people on Fox News to make it seem like night is day and day is night. But you can't win these kinds of basic clerical 99 out of 100 judges are going to shut you down arguments when you're just defying subpoenas and define very clear statutes. And the more you lose, the more you're likely to lose, the more future judges don't feel like they're going to be the ones who get blamed for shutting down Trump. So, you know, it does seem like an attack of 1,000 pellet guns, and it may be the way to topple, you know,
right,
an authoritarian, shall we say.
Yes. I thought you were going to say the Orange Duce or something like that, but
well,
I said it for you. I thank you for joining us, Edward McCaffrey.
Okay, no problem. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I'll be speaking with Edmund McCaffrey, who is the Robert C. Packard Trustee Chair in Law and the Professor of Law, Economics, and Political Science at the University of Southern California. He's the author of Fair Not Flat, How to Make the Tax System Better and Simpler, and the founder of the People's Tax Page. We can take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into Trump's border wall at $1 billion a mile.
Now don't ask me what is love. If you don't want to pay, pay some more. Cause I'm the tax man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Diane, who's the executive editor of The American Prospect and a contributing writer to The Intercept and The New Republic, among other publications, the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize. He is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and most recently, Fat Cat, The Steve Mnuchin Story. And he has an article at The American Prospect, The Secret Vote That Could Wipe Away Consumer Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Dayen.
Thank you.
So, David, before we get to your article, we was talking about Steve Mnuchin and how the tax returns issues is closing in on Trump on many fronts, with New York State today ruling that they're going to hand over his tax returns to the Congress. But Mnuchin's actually broken the law. The law is pretty straightforward.
It's rather straightforward, yes.
Yeah,
in the last day or so, right, there's been a release of an internal memo from the Internal Revenue Service saying, yeah, we have to give the tax returns. There's no kind of option here.
Sure, and in today he was in testimony before the House Financial Services Committee. He denied that the memo, IRS internal memo, contradicted him. He was more focused on going after who wrote it and said that he hasn't broken the law. But he seems like a real candidate. Right. If there's some way for the Congress to show some resolve here, they ought to have the Capitol Police arrest this guy. I just can't believe how flagrant it is. But, you know,
it's funny. I mean, he said the same thing when I released the memo about One West Bank and the California Attorney General's office recommending prosecution for them. He blamed the person who leaked that memo and said he did nothing wrong legally. So I guess he has a playbook for this kind of stuff.
So let's talk a little bit about the wall. It's obvious that Trump's been throwing red meat to his base with a not exactly subtle racist subtext that, you know, you're the endangered white people and the Democrats only care about brown people and that they're invading our country and all this kind of stuff. But to some extent, using immigration as a wedge issue, as he does, disguises what's actually really happening down there on the border. And we've just gotten a report now from Bloomberg that says that the U.S. border wall funding of $1.57 billion has only built 1.7 miles of fence. So Trump is basically spending $1 billion a mile on his fence. And you got to believe that some of those contractors are looting the treasury on the way.
I mean, welcome to the wonderful world of U.S. infrastructure, right? I mean, this is not an isolated incident of cost overruns when you're talking about particularly a federal job where the wall thing is more symbol than reality anyway. So I'm sure that the contractors who have been tasked with putting up the minimal amount that has been authorized see dollar signs when they see something like this, because they know that it's more of a theory than practice anyway. So it's kind of anything goes on the contracting side. And we see this in defense contracting. We see this in all sorts of different contexts. Anytime you have federal contractors and consultants lining up, watch your wallet.
Well, we've already seen that the outgoing former head of DHS and now then he was the chief of staff in the White House. General Kelly. He's now on the board of one of the big contractors that is overseeing and supplying those kind of cages they put kids in.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't surprising, right? I mean, George W. Bush's Homeland Security Director, Michael Chertoff, ended up being part of the company that creates those scanners at the TSA when you go to the airport. So small surprise that was the company that got the contract for that. I mean, this revolving door stuff, it's really pernicious and something that, you know, we really need to do a comprehensive look at and try to end this practice once and for all, because it's debilitating to the whole notion of government as a force for progress.
Well, but do you think that it could be this cynical that Trump doesn't really care about his wall, whether it's built or not, as long as something looks like it's happening? And he's got the military down there, and he's now diverting military funds going around Congress. But at the end of the day, the only people who are winning out of this are his cronies, people who like Kelly and others. So this seems
to
be the...
I mean, if you want to be more cynical about it, Ian, you can say that Trump doesn't want the wall built, because if he gets it built, then what's he gonna yell about? You know, what's the impetus for re-election if the wall is done? right? So he needs the sort of concept, the unfinished concept of that wall to be out there so that he has something that he can agitate about.
And again, I'm speaking with David Dayan, who is the executive editor of The American Prospect and a contributing writer to The Intercept and The New Republic, among other publications. He's the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize, and he's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and most recently, Fat Cat, The Steve Mnuchin Story. And he has an article at The American Prospect, The Secret Vote That Could Wipe Away Consumer Rights. So let's talk about that article. What is going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, it has a happy ending, but it was kind of drastic to begin with. So there's this elite society of legal minds called the American Law Institute, and periodically they do these things that they call restatements. They're really kind of the cliff notes for what the law says in certain contexts, common law that's in all 50 states. And it's used very influential. It's used by judges, it's used by lawyers, law students, to really interpret what the law is. And there was kind of this radical reinterpretation that was teed up for consumer contract law, which would have made it such that if you visited a website or if you walked into a department store or some retail facility, just by your presence, you would be bound to the terms and conditions of that business under a contract as long as they gave you some sort of notice that a contract existed. You didn't really have to see it in order to give your agreement to abide by its terms. And this would completely overturn like doctrines of mutual assent and contract law. It wrestled with kind of a real problem, this problem that nobody reads the terms of a contract, even if it says click to agree that I have read all terms and conditions. Nobody really reads those. But the idea that the solution is, okay, then we'll just say that you're agreeing to the contract, whether you agreed to it or not, or even read it, or even knew of its existence, is a really radical reinterpretation of the law. And consumer advocates were just completely alarmed by this. And it was kind of flying under the radar until our story on Monday. And then, it got some more attention. Elizabeth Warren, who was a vice chair in the past of the American Law Institute, came out against it. Richard Cordray, the former head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, basically anyone who's everyone in consumer protection was vigorously opposed to this. And so the vote to approve this restatement, this reinterpretation, was on Tuesday. And after a vigorous debate, 4 hours of debate, I'm told, ultimately it was tabled. It was postponed. And I don't think that would have happened without the sort of more widespread attention that this got, sunlight being the best disinfectant, as I believe Louis Brandeis once said. So it's really an eye-opening kind of look into this obscure legal society that has a lot of power to really almost rewrite the law without even changing a word.
So back to the wall that's costing $1.57 billion for 1.7 miles of fence, so roughly a billion a mile. One of the things that I thought sort of encapsulated this team of grifters that Trump has in his cabinet, and the idea that for all of his populist rhetoric, he's basically copying Putin's MO of creating a kind of government kleptocracy where the insiders are able to loot the treasury. I don't know that he regulates the oligarchs in the way that Putin does and stashes billions abroad, but we'll find out, I guess. But I thought yesterday's testimony by the head of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, mm-hmm. Dr. Ben Carson, was so shocking. He really doesn't know a damn thing about that agency or that government department.
Right.
He doesn't know anything.
Let's explain what happened. So Katie Porter, who's a congresswoman from right here in California, in Orange County in Irvine, asked Ben Carson about REO. And REO stands for real estate owned. And it means that after a foreclosure, this is how they denote housing that then can go back on the market. It's just a jargon in the housing industry, very common, and HUD deals with REO after there are foreclosures all the time. And Ben Carson replied, "Oreo?" I mean, he really thought that she was talking about cookies, sandwich cookies, and not a basic building block piece of jargon that is fundamental to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It was really mind blowing, and you kind of wonder what Ben Carson does all day. And it is an absolute testament to the fact that the cronies that Trump has put into these cabinet agencies are woefully unqualified for these positions. They're there, in some cases, just to sort of give out favors to industry and wealthy friends. I don't know what Ben Carson is really doing at HUD, other than he was minimally popular among Republicans because he ran for president, and so he threw him a bone. That agency and his presence there just absolutely baffles me.
Well, it was worse than his ignorance. It was his arrogance that he clearly does not care about the people that HUD is supposed to take care of. That was the part. I mean, we know that he tried to have the most expensive furniture in his office, and maybe that's where his focus is, on having a nice office, because he twiddles his thumbs all day long. But
right.
The long and the short of it is that there are a lot of people out there that need HUD's help. And he didn't even know how many people were on the waiting list. He didn't know the first thing about what they're doing. And the worst part of it was he doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, I mean, it happens obviously at a much higher level than him. And when you're talking about REO, you're talking about these properties that now are in the hands of HUD and frequently are going out to be sold to Wall Street investors, hedge funds and private equity firms and things like that. And they either turn around and rent them out, which causes a certain degree of misery. We've seen all kinds of stories about these hedge fund owned properties that are put out for rental, including Tom Barrack's company, the Trump crony, Colony Capital, had quite a bit of these properties, and just absolute, you know, maintenance nightmares, jacking up rents, all kinds of stuff like that. These things have a real impact, as you said, and Ben Carson has no idea, apparently, what's going on within this agency that is really fundamental. I mean, you're talking about people's homes, right? You're talking about the ability of someone to find shelter. These are low-income people who get vouchers and things like that, and who really have no other lifeline for support. And Ben Carson isn't even bothering or deigning to actually understand or pay any attention to these serious issues that affect so many people.
Well, just in closing, David Dayan, what did you think of Trump's hissy fit today in the Rose Garden?
Well, it's funny because Nancy Pelosi's statement afterwards was really kind of revealing, because, you know, the conceit was that Trump was doing this because he was whining about, you know, these investigations that were going on. But what Pelosi revealed is that the previous day, Trump sent her some sort of communication saying that he wasn't going to go forward with any infrastructure plan until the Democrats passed his trade deal with Canada and Mexico, the NAFTA 2.0. So that puts a whole different spin on this, that this was just kind of a cover for Trump trying to put pressure to pass this trade deal so he could get a win that he can use for his reelection campaign. So I thought that was one of the more interesting parts. I mean, everything else is obviously it's the same hissy fit that he's been throwing forever.
Well, but he, you know, the fact that she said earlier that he's engaged in a cover-up, that's essentially what he was complaining about. But interesting enough, I had a guest on yesterday who used to be Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff, And he thought that what is happening now in terms of Trump blocking anything and everything coming from the Congress and not even recognizing the Congress's role in oversight of the executive branch is actually a stronger case against him than impeaching him for what's in the Mueller report. And Trump played right into that hand.
I think in some weird way, Trump wants to be impeached.
Oh, yeah.
That he sees it as first of all, he sees himself as protected by the Senate, by Republicans in the Senate, and he sees it as this oppositional kind of tribal thing that he can point to in the 2020 election, that he actually thinks it would benefit him. Now, whether it would or not is anybody's guess, but you really have this unbelievable lawlessness when you have a president who actually is courting impeachment and doing everything he can to sort of troll the opposition party to get them to do it. It's really one of the more unique situations in American history.
Well, David Dayen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Dayen, who is the executive editor of the American Prospect and a contributing writer to The Intercept and The New Republic, among other publications. He's the winner of the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize, and he's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and most recently, Fat Cat, the Steve Mnuchin story. And he has an article at The American Prospect, The Secret Vote That Could Wipe Away Consumer Rights. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the bizarre story uncovered in documents obtained from the Russian troll factory of plans to recruit a group of prominent gangbangers to send them to Africa for demolition training so that they can return to the U.S. to wreak mayhem and create a separate country.
It's the money.
This is a diabolic, diabolic scheme. Diabolic scheme. This is a diabolic, diabolic scheme.
Diabolic scheme.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Casey Michelle, who is a reporter with Think Progress, who has worked as a journalist in both the United States and the former Soviet Union. His articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Politico, The Washington Post, Talking Points Memo, Moscow Times, and Business Insider. Welcome to Background Briefing, Casey Michelle.
Ian, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And these recently uncovered documents that came out of a group in London who monitor Russia, financed by the former billionaire who was jailed by Putin, Khodorkovsky, they reveal that the Internet Research Agency in Prigozhin, otherwise known as Putin's chef, seriously considered a plot to round up America's top gangbangers, send them to Africa, arm them, train them in explosives, etc., and ideology, and then return them to the United States to declare a separate country. In fact, there's a funny article at The Root by Michael Harriet that refers to the country as Black Menistan. So you got to laugh. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. How far up the chain did this go? How seriously should we take this?
Yeah, Ian, that's a great question, and I think that there are two responses that we should keep in mind when we look through these documents, when we look through what these plans envision. On the one hand, it's an absolutely ridiculous, ludicrous, and farcical idea that these individuals over in Russia would be able to recruit, whether it's gang members or criminals or whomever they thought, to take them over to somewhere in Africa, train them in explosives, train them in IEDs, send them back to the U.S., and have them carve out their own separate state, as Michael said at the root, what they could call Black Manistan. It's an absolutely ludicrous, farcical idea, and we can get a little bit more into the details of that as we go along. But on the other hand, I do think it's worth keeping in mind that this is a project that an organization over in Russia, that is the Internet Research Agency, which has been responsible for so many social media operations on Facebook, on Twitter, especially in 2016, but then obviously afterward. I mean, this was the key organization responsible for one of the key prongs of Russian interference. This is something they were considering. For some reason, one of their individuals who was working there, one of the individuals who was relatively high up, thought that it would be a good idea to go to his boss, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who you just mentioned is close to Russian President Vladimir Putin, and say, you know what would be a good idea? You know what would be worth our time to do? Again, recruit these individuals, send them to Africa, and then bring them back to the U.S. to break up the U.S. This is the kind of design, these are the kind of individuals, and this is the kind of overarching strategy that that they had. Obviously, it wasn't implemented, and obviously, it was something that would never likely be successful in the short, medium, or long term. But it is worth keeping in mind that this is the kind of group, these are the kind of individuals, and again, given their higher status or their ranks in the Russian government, this is the kind of reach that they had. These are the types of individuals that we are focusing on, that we should be concerned about, even if their ideas are as ludicrous as what they seem to have put forth in these documents.
So the documents, as I mentioned, Mikhail Khodorkovsky was the richest man in Russia, but he had the temerity of starting to invest his money in liberal political parties, which infuriated Putin, and Putin jailed him on trumped-up charges in the Gulag, and he had a pretty rough time, and he had his fortune confiscated, and Putin's cronies now own all of his assets. But he must have got something out of the country because he runs this center in London called the Dossier Center, and the documents that we're talking about, one of them, this blueprint that we're discussing, was entitled Development Strategy of a Pan-African State on U.S. Territory. So have you had a chance to look at these documents?
I have, yes. The organization that published them, the Mikhail Khodorkovsky's organization, the Dossier Center, actually has them available on their website, if any of the listeners would like to go take a look at them. It's not long. It's about maybe 5 or 6 pages total that details some of these operations. I think the most interesting thing that stands out to me isn't so much the text as it is actually the map that they posted. And you can see on the map, it goes from Texas over to Georgia. They highlight about a half dozen states where they think that they would be able to implement these operations. For each state, they also list one of these fake Facebook pages that they were responsible for. So these are pages that are targeted at, in one instance, Texas secessionists, in some other instances, African-Americans, that they could point to as saying, look, we were already successful in recruiting, you know, 200,000 or 300,000 Facebook followers to these pages. Why don't you give us the green light to go ahead with this next operation that is, again, sending these individuals over, again, somewhere in Africa, training them in explosives, sending them back to the U.S. so that they can break off the southern states, Texas, Mississippi, Alabama. I think what's also indicative of this map that they put together, just the kind of, again, ludicrous nature of this plan, is that they were not able to get even the basic facts of these states correct. So, for instance, they have Dallas listed as the capital of Texas, or Birmingham listed as the capital of Alabama. They say Mississippi is 80% black, which is about double what it really is. You know, these are basic pieces of information that point to the ridiculousness of this project. I don't know if they just don't have proper funding for researchers within their team over there, but I think it is worth keeping in mind just how serious they were in putting this project together. And I think, Ian, something that you and I have talked about in the past is that it's not simply concerning that they would have this idea in the first place or commit it to paper or commit it to actually pitching it to their higher ups. I do think there is something worth being said that this is a kind of almost a corporate structure, in the sense that, well, we want to get funding for a project, so we want to make it as outlandish or plausible, or whatever it may be, as it may seem. You know, the bosses aren't going to check the final numbers. They're not going to check what the actual capital of Texas is. Let's put four, five, six pages together in a proposal, send it to them, and maybe at the end of the day we can get the money for it, whether it's successful or not. Maybe they don't care so much, so long as they're getting a piece of their pie, which again is very much a top-down means of funding in Russia. All the purse strings are controlled by Putin and his inner circle, and if they can get a piece of that pie, they're willing to say that, oh, we can absolutely get these southern states to break off. Why don't you give us the funding for it? Just give us some time. Maybe we'll be successful. Maybe we won't. Let's see. Just give us the money.
And again, I'm speaking with Casey Michel, who's currently a reporter with Think Progress, who has worked as a journalist in both the United States and the former Soviet Union. And his articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Politico, The Washington Post, Talking Points Memo, The Moscow Times, and Business Insider. So what's the website, by the way, to look at these documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have it in front of me. It's either dossiercenter.org or dossiercenter.com. If listeners just Google, in quotes, Dossier Center,
it'll come up,
be the
right.
The first hit for them, yeah.
But the methodology in Putin's kleptocracy is that Prigozhin, his chef, who runs the IRA, the Internet Research Agency, that were the ones that did all the trolling that the Mueller report reported, and 13 of them, including the one guy that was involved in or two of the people that were involved in this ridiculous plan, they were named in the indictments by Robert Mueller that came down in February of 2018. The IRA, of course, is just one branch of Prigozhin's. He also runs a mercenary army called the Wagners. They're active in Africa. And it looks like they were responsible for the murder of some Russian journalists recently. But the way that it works for Prigozhin, the reason he's a billionaire, is that he has an exclusive contract, thanks to Putin, to feed the Russian military. He's their major caterer. And then he gets the kickbacks from that is, billions just go out under the table, from the contracts. So that's how the system works, isn't it?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There is a small coterie of individuals that many of whom have been close to Putin for years, even predating his presidency, when they were either working in government or they were potentially working in the kind of nascent private sector in Russia, and that have risen with Putin ever since. Say what you will about President Putin, but boy, he likes to take care of his friends. And that's not Prigozhin. That's everyone else that's risen through him, that's part of his inner circle. He will go out of his way to make sure that they are able to maintain monopolies in certain sectors, whether it is feeding the Russian military, whether it's Russian railways, whether it's the oil and gas sector, whatever he can do to make sure that their pockets are as fat as possible. And in so doing, keep them close, keep them reliant on him, keep them reliant on his good graces and his leadership and his position at the head of the Kremlin. It's not as if it's simply Putin saying, someone in Siberia gets this or someone in the Caucasus gets that. It's very clear that there's a small organization, a small group, as analysts like to say, a collective Putin. It's not just him as the leader. It's him, this small coterie. Prigozhin absolutely fits within that small group of individuals, and he has benefited handsomely to the tune of billion or billions of dollars, as well as a number of other individuals, which makes actually this document that much more interesting, because it's not just some random individual sitting in a cubicle in Moscow who's typing up this document, or some random individual in Vladivostok who had an idea about getting Texas to secede. I mean, these are high-ranking individuals. These are folks that actually have Putin's ear, or know individuals who have Putin's ears, which unfortunately does make a document like this worth paying attention to. I mean, again, it is worth keeping in mind the ridiculous nature of it, but at the same token, we've seen ridiculous ideas implemented in the past, and there's no reason to think that if they had taken time, that they wouldn't have been able to try to implement this. How it would have gone down, I guess we'll never know, but it's certainly something to keep in the back of our mind.
But the kickback embezzlement model that they use, first of all, Putin's cronies have stolen so much from Gazprom. It's just amazing. Gazprom had something like $360+ billion about in its reserves about maybe 10 years ago. I'm not sure the exact figures. Now it's down to about $30 billion. And Prigozhin, he has the exclusive contract to feed the Russian military, but he siphons off tons of that money for himself and for his other projects. And that means that the soldiers, sailors, and airmen in the Russian military are getting shoddy second-rate rations, right? Because the guy's creaming the profit.
Yeah. Yeah, Ian, and unfortunately, this is something that the late Soviet Union and then on to modern Russia has had to deal with for the past 30, 40 years. I don't know if any of our listeners are familiar with the new HBO show Chernobyl about, again, the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. But that does an excellent point of highlighting the type of official malfeasance that led to, again, shoddy construction, shoddy maintenance, in this instance, shoddy food, shoddy supplies. You know, we can point to any number of examples. I think it is worth highlighting because this is something that doesn't get a lot of discussion in the U.S. It's not simply that kind of financial malfeasance, and it's not simply you know, keeping his friends as close as possible and lining their pocketbooks, but the wealth disparity in Russia. I mean, obviously, we have to deal with this to a significant extent and increasing significance here in the U.S. But the U.S. at the moment has nothing on Russia. I'm just looking through my notes right now with a couple stats that stand out. That again, Prigozhin and Putin and that inner circle is absolutely responsible for. So one stat that came out just in April was the wealthiest 3% of Russians own 89% of all financial assets in Russia. We have fewer than 100 Russian billionaires now have a combined wealth greater than the entire population's savings. And the top 10% of Russians own 87% of everything. So this is a wealth disparity, a wealth gap that has been absolutely exacerbated. It will absolutely be the legacy of Putin and his friends beyond just shoddy food, beyond just shoddy construction. It is the absolute immiseration of an entire country. You know, rising living standards have stalled in Russia. We see increasing pressure on local governments that we haven't seen at any point over the last 15 years or even 20 years, even since Putin came to power. I mean, this is not something that's going to end anytime soon. It is a stagnation that the Soviet Union dealt with in the late 70s and early 80s that eventually led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. How this current stagnation ends, you know, I don't know. But unfortunately, it does seem as if Putin's inner circle is going to ride it out as long as they can. And that includes individuals like Prigozhin himself.
Well, one of the consequences of the rape and pillaging of Russia by Putin and his cronies and the Siloviki is that there was a recent study that found that over 40% of young Russians want to emigrate either to Germany or the United States.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Again, one of the outgrowths of this, again, immiseration, pillaging and plundering of the domestic population is that there is no incentive or there is very little incentive for domestic entrepreneurs or investors or even for that matter, foreign investors to come to Russia to keep their money there, to keep their efforts and energy there. You know, we see this time and again where brilliant Russian engineers, are forced to take their ideas, are forced to take their genius elsewhere, whether it's to Europe, whether it's thankfully here to the U.S. to create the types of economic engines that lead to job growth, that lead to expanding companies, that lead to expanding wealth for the rest of us. It is unfortunately, as we see play out in authoritarian dictatorships time and again, and Russia under Putin is an excellent example of that. It is a short-term gain for a small coterie of individuals at a medium and long-term expense. And, you know, this is going to be a massive project and a massive recovery in the post-Putin world in Russia. What developments we see after that, I don't know, but it's not something that's going to be fixed in any kind of vantage of the foreseeable future. I mean, this is going to be a decades-long process to try to gain back what that country has lost due to Putin's leadership, due to the Putin regime, and due to those individuals like Prigozhin who have surrounded Putin and helped cement that power. It's Russia should be and could still be at some point in the future, a massive economic powerhouse. At the moment, it has a GDP that's smaller than Texas. It's smaller than New York. It's smaller than California. There's no reason that should be the case. You know, we have a massive brain drain that has been continuing for years out of that country. You can only hope that that will stop and that the trend will reverse sooner rather than later, not for Putin's sake, but for just the average Russian's sake moving forward.
Well, just in closing, of course, one of Putin's biggest admirers is President Donald Trump, and we don't know the nature of their relationship, except to say that at every term, Trump defers to him and he won't even pull him over from interfering in our elections and for the possibility or the probability that he's going to interfere in the elections in 2020 if he's not already doing it. So it's a very peculiar thing. But there's no question that Trump is a kind of mirror of Putin, and obviously not on the scale of Putin's kleptocracy. But Trump is surrounded by a team of grifters in his cabinet. I don't know whether you saw Ben Carson's testimony yesterday. The guy doesn't know a damn thing about HUD, and he doesn't care. He literally doesn't. He just wants to have expensive furniture in his office. He just doesn't care about those people that he's supposed to take care of. He didn't even know how many people had applied for housing. And then, you know, Trump's building his wall on the southern border. So far, Trump has built 1.7 miles
Yeah,
of
almost 2 miles.
Almost, yeah, 1.7 miles. Guess how much it cost? $1.5 billion. So we're talking about roughly $1 billion a mile. All that money's been stolen by cronies and contractors. It's exactly like Putin, except, you know, he hasn't – Trump mercifully doesn't control the purse strings. He's got Mnuchin doing that, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's very clear at this point. It's been very clear since the campaign, even before the 2016 election, that Trump looks enviously upon individuals like Putin or Kim Jong-un or President Xi in China, or for that matter, Viktor Orban in Hungary, looking at the kind of fealty that they've been able to command, looking at the control that they've been able to consolidate in their respective regimes, looking at the way they've been able to clamp down on non-state publications, looking at the way they've been able to control the purse strings. At every piece, every bit of evidence shows that this is an absolutely illiberal president. This is an absolutely authoritarian or autocratic-minded president. You know, there's every reason to say when he jokes about, and I don't know if you saw this just a couple weeks ago, Ian, you know, him joking about lifting term limits and remaining in power for maybe 10 or 12 or 14 years and then saying, oh, well, I was just joking. Oh, I just want to laugh it off. You know, this is not, unfortunately, a joke for the man that we currently have in the Oval Office. Thankfully, for our sake, there are term limits. There doesn't seem to be any kind of workaround within the kind of domestic American constitutional structure at the moment. But again, Trump would like nothing more than to remain in office in perpetuity. I mean, if for no other reason that he's going to be facing significant legal troubles after he's out of office. And I think he's perfectly aware of that. But again, that also plays into the envy that he shows time and again for those anti-democratic forces, anti-democratic leaders, anti-American leaders, for that matter, across the world. And that's Putin, that's Xi, that's Kim, that's Orban. It's any number of them. He is absolutely of that make and matter. And thankfully for the rest of us, there's an election coming up in just about 18 months where he'll have to stand in a free and fair election, unlike what we see in Russia or in China. And he will have to respect the results of that election, no matter what they may show.
Well, Casey Michelle, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Absolutely. Anytime, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Casey Michelle, who's currently a reporter with Think Progress. He's worked as a journalist in both the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, and his articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Politico, The Washington Post, Talking Points Memo, Moscow Times, and Business Insider. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.